Medieval literature is teeming with references to fantastical, miraculous, or topographical islands. From the island mountain of Dante's Purgatorio to the Isle of Avalon in Arthurian legend, and from cartographic artifacts like isolarios to utopian writing, there's an abundance of references to islands in pre-modern texts. I'm Sarah Torres, and I'm here with Nahir Otaño Gracia. Together, we're editing a cluster for the journal Viator on the topic of islands and insularity.
Hi, everyone. We are very lucky to be joined today with three of our contributors, and to be honest, three of the most amazing, coolest people I've ever met.
Tanvir Ahmed is an assistant professor at the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. His work focuses on Islamic social movements, imaginaries, and philosophies of history between pre-modern Central Asia, South Asia, and the Middle East. In addition to his scholarship, his works of short fiction have been published at various forums.
Taryn Andrews is an assistant professor of Native American and Indigenous Studies at Yale University. Her current book project engages Old English law and literature to examine the relationship between language and settler colonialism, theorizing that there is some linguistic specificity to settler colonial structures in the Anglophone world and their insular beginnings. Last but not least is Jonathan Correa Reyes. Jonathan is an assistant professor of English at Clemson University. His research interests reside at the intersection of literary studies, postcolonial studies, and pre-modern critical race. His work has been supported by the Ford Foundation. Jonathan is also a co-founder and co-producer of the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast, so we're very lucky to have him here with us. We wanted to begin with thinking a little bit what we mean by insular. It means in some ways more than we could actually say, because insular writing has these ideas of islands and a sense of separation. But my first understanding of insular is from Antonio S. Pedreira's Insularismo, a book that continues to be understood as defining Puerto Rican identity, and also a book that a lot of Puerto Ricans reject as a book that should be defining Puerto Rican identity. And as such, my understanding of insularismo and insularity runs deep. And I would say that, in a way, for me, this cluster is also a way with breaking with that sort of way that insularismo is understood for me as a Puerto Rican.
Right. So at the heart of the definition and the use of the term insular or insularity is this inherent tension between the idea that islands are associated, I mean, etymologically, with isolation, with separateness, with alterity, and then this other paradigm in which islands are associated with connectivity, with archipelagos, with patternings, and they serve as cultural contact zones. And I first became interested in islands or their representation in literature, first through early research on travelers' accounts of St. Patrick's Purgatory in Ireland and the voyage of St. Brendan, in which there are lots of islands on the saint's itinerary, but also for more personal reasons. I grew up in Puerto Rico, and I've always been interested in what it means personally, ecologically, and politically to be from an island region, especially in a time of climate change. So that sense of precarity.
Absolutely. And I think maybe we should start with that. Both Sarah and I are Puerto Rican, and that's part of what brought us together to do this work, is that sense of what does it mean to be an islander, and what does it mean to be interested in islands as scholars of the Middle Ages.
Absolutely. And also this kind of discursive tendency to talk about islands as a region that's opposed to like a mainland. I think that speaks to some of the center periphery paradigms that are operative not only in contemporary thought and political discourse, but also, of course, in ways of understanding pre-modern power structures. That's something that I think several essays in our issue are exploring. One of the things that really struck me when I started paying closer attention to islands in literature and medieval documents was, in fact, how different they were. And this is reflected in just the wide range of methodological approaches and textual artifacts that our contributors explore in the Viator cluster. So islands in medieval texts can be replicable. They can be itinerant. They can be tied to the temporalities of literature, scripture, or climate. They can float sort of tantalizingly at the edges of cartographic knowledge, as the Fortunate Islands do, or they can feature as a centralizing force. You can have islands that are created by floods or catastrophes, islands that are fixed versus those with no fixed coordinates, tidal islands such as Mont Saint-Michel, river islands, or islands that are actually whales, as we get in the Navigatio Sancti Brendani Abbatis, which is discussed by one of our contributors, Andrea Wachten, in the issue. And my sense of the scope of insularity as a critical term in medieval studies has only grown after getting to know the work of some of the wonderful scholars contributing to this project. Nahir, your book focuses on the North Atlantic. Are there particular manifestations of insularity or islands that have really grabbed your attention when working on this project?
Absolutely. We are so lucky to have the contributors that we have and the work that we have. And it has been really amazing. And for me, you know, with my own work, so one of the things is I work on the global North Atlantic. And I really think it's important for me to add that global to it, because when we think of the global, right, and the global Middle Ages, one of the things that it does is that it provincializes Europe. So when I think of the global North Atlantic, I am also trying to think of the ways that it provincializes the North Atlantic and the way that we understand the North Atlantic. And so for me, my work is also trying to highlight the role of islands in understanding movement, right? But also how places like the Isle of Man and the Balearic Islands and the Caribbean are sources of knowledge that are central to understanding how Europe is functioning. And these essays in the cluster made me realize why it is that more and more I think we have to think in this global way and think about the ways that Europe is provincialized.
And you're part of this groundbreaking critical work, Nahir, in which islands have received increased critical attention in the past decade. Mediterranean studies has for many decades been at the vanguard of these approaches and the ways that medieval studies can be put into just really rich, productive dialogue with Caribbean studies, studies that focus on other oceanic regions or world regions like Pacific studies also seems to me a really sort of rich avenue of emerging research. In the past decade or so, there have been a few works that have come out, works of scholarship that are particularly relevant to our project. And I wanted to mention them for those of you listening who are interested in learning more about the current conversations. So Matthew Boyd Goldie and Sebastian Sobecki's edited collection, Our Sea of Islands, was one important contribution. And James Smith's essay in particular shaped my thinking on the Columbus logbooks and the voyage of St. Brendan. Simone Pinet's Archipelagos, Insular Fictions from Chivalric Romance to the Novel also focuses on this idea of insularity and the Iberian genre of isolarios. And then scholars working in fields such as blue humanities, spatial justice, the global Middle Ages, and critical race studies, especially Geraldine Hang, have all contributed to this particular avenue of research and inquiry.
Absolutely. And I would also add Geraldine Hang's Empire of Magic, which has been instrumental in how I understand my work. And I think, especially for this project, the contributors had their thinking shaped by each other. So one of the things that we worked really hard to do, and I hope that has come across to the writers, is that we really wanted to do this in community. In my institution at the University of New Mexico, they often want to talk a lot about community-based research. And it always seems to imply that is these academics that are leaving the university and going into other communities and doing work. and some of my colleagues are doing amazing work. I also realized that we ourselves, the university academia, we are ourselves different kinds of communities, and there are ways that we could do community engaged research that is about how we work together. And so from the very beginning of this project, it has been very much about maintaining and creating community. I am so thankful to Sara, who wrote to me, I think it was Siwani. It was still in the pandemic. The conference was online, but Sara is like, well, technically we're in the same conference, so let's have coffee together on Zoom. And she invited me to this coffee date, and I loved it. We had coffee. I made sure to bring my coffee. She had her coffee. We had an hour-long conversation, and I just kept thinking, how do I not know this person? How is Sara and I not friends yet? And from there, Sarah's like, let's do this project together. Even from that very beginning, it expanded my community. I am so thankful to have Sara now and to be able to say that she's a colleague and a conspirator and a friend.
It was Nahira's idea as part of this co-edited cluster to create more opportunities for conversation, support, and collaboration at the draft writing phase. And in that sense, I suppose we were very intentionally moving against an insular or an isolated model of scholarship in which everyone is working separately in silo, and to invite opportunities for collaboration, for community. So Nahira organized a series, I think, of four peer workshops where the contributors could share their work at an earlier draft phase than would normally be the case. And one of the wonderful things is many people have had the opportunity to engage with each other's work. And I think that does allow for the formation of through lines between and amongst the papers. Also exploring methodologically how we can use this form of academic publishing to not just create individual articles, but to create conversations and indeed to create friendship, I think, along the way.
We presented the papers to each other, and I like to think that everybody learned a little bit from each other. Everybody gave each other feedback. And now, even doing this podcast, I feel that there are many ways in which we can create research in community that is not just about writing the paper. It's about who you write the paper with, who you're writing it for. And honestly, that to me has been one of the most exciting parts of this project. It has felt that my community has grown because of it. And one of these, after we did the workshop, Tanvir stayed over and we talked maybe 30 minutes of just meeting each other and learning about each other. And again, I left that meeting. How did I not know Tanvir from before now? And my life is now better because of that. So not only am I immensely proud of the scholarship that's going to come out of this journal, I am just thankful that I feel that I have expanded my community.
Open up the conversation now to some of the contributors to this issue on insularity. So, John, can you tell us a little bit more about how the concept of insularity features in your own work and what the medieval or contemporary associations or connotations of insularity are?
Gracias, Sara. I must admit it's an interesting dynamic when I'm not the one doing the interview for this podcast. As the third very proud Puerto Rican of this group, I do think there is something fundamentally unique about growing up and learning to be a part of the world as an islander. I think that my experience as an islander has shaped my reading practices, the questions I ask of my sources, and the arguments I'm interested in making as a literary scholar. I think it's important for me to mention my background because it is inextricable from how I understand insularity as a critical concept. Unlike people who use this term to emphasize isolation, the kind of siloed academic praxis that you spoke about earlier, Sara, I choose to use this term as a way of emphasizing and creating connectivity. Growing up in Puerto Rico, I remember many of my neighbors from Dominican Republic, some were from Jamaica. I remember that in elementary school, most of my teachers were from Cuba. As an undergraduate at the University of Puerto Rico, I had the good fortune of learning from scholars from Trinidad and Tobago, Spain, the United States, and England. I remember driving through the town of Vega Alta once and asking my father about the Al-Farouk Mosque as we passed by it. I remember learning about the significant wave of Jewish immigrants to the island towards the end of the 19th century and the early decades of the 20th century. It was in Puerto Rico that I fell in love with the literatures of the medieval world, that I became inspired by Latin American struggles for independence, and also fell in love with Studio Ghibli films. And every Puerto Rican knows that the best Chinese food can be found in our isla. So, in perhaps a rather roundabout way, what I'm trying to say is that my experience as an insular subject has rarely centered feelings of isolation. And perhaps this is what informed my approach to my contribution to this wonderful cluster. Now, I feel the need to mention that this piece is my very first publication, and somewhat of an outlier if we want to be too strict about our historical categories, which we shouldn't, because although I am a medievalist, this piece deals with the 16th century poet Juan Latino. That being said, I'm very glad that this is the first entry in my publication record, because I am in awe of Juan Latino as a historical figure. And this idea of insularity as a mode of connection really helped me to articulate what I think he is doing in some of his poems. So Juan Latino was a 16th century black poet from Iberia who achieved significant renown. He was enslaved for the early part of his life, but having learned Latin so well, after he attains his freedom, he taught Latin at the Cathedral School of Granada. He gained such fame for his poetry, which he composed in Latin, that King Philip II, or Felipe II, commissioned poems from him, one of which was an epic poem celebrating the Christian victory over the Ottoman forces at the Battle of Lepanto. A much debated question about Juan Latino is his place of birth. In one of his published volumes, he claims that he comes from Ethiopia, yet scholars think that he was actually born in Spain. To make a long story short, I look at mentions of Ethiopia in some of his poetry. What he means by Ethiopia is also another fraught conversation. It could have been a way of acknowledging his blackness, it could have referred to the country of Ethiopia, or it could have been a shorthand for all of sub-Saharan Africa. I am not interested in his reference to Ethiopia as a geographical boundary so much as a deliberate attempt at self-fashioning. Latino uses Ethiopia to argue for his equal humanity when compared to the white faces who look down on black bodies. He writes, and I quote the translation, "For if our black face displeases your servants, O king, a white one is not pleasing to the men of Ethiopia. There a white man who visits the east is considered vile, and there are black leaders and a dark-skinned king." To use your term, Nair, I think that through his use of Ethiopia, Latino is provincializing Europe. He wants Europeans to see Ethiopia as an equal, but aware that Europeans have a history of enslaving those who look different, Latino presents Ethiopia as a place that escapes the colonizing arm of Europe. Thus, I speak of Ethiopia in Latino's poetry as an island of sorts, one that is visible from European shores, but beyond the reach of Europe's colonizing arm, connected as equals. To return to where I started, I am thinking of insularity as a form of connection. In my thinking, I'm very much indebted to Aimé Césaire, Frantz Fanon, and Sylvia Winter. But here I'm specifically thinking perhaps of Glissant's metaphor of the Caribbean archipelago as a new way of relating to the world. His Poetics of Relation and Creolization, where difference thrives in networks as opposed to hierarchies. This is what I think Latino is doing in his poems.
Wonderful. Taryn, I noticed that your contribution also makes use of some of the scholarly traditions and voices that John just mentioned. Earlier in our conversation, we talked about how at the heart of this discourse or critical concept of insularity is a kind of tension between connectivity or multiplicity, contact, and separateness, alterity, isolation. And I think that's also an idea that you explore and theorize in your work. So I wanted to invite you to jump in and share your thoughts about how your work theorizes and grapples with the idea of the insular.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And just what a pleasure it is to be in conversation with all of you today. It's so good to see so many of you, even though it's on a screen. But anyway, the way that I approached this really incredible call for papers was to think through how insularity as a concept has inadvertently shaped my relationship to the North Atlantic. I'm not a person who identifies as an islander. I'm from Montana originally. It doesn't feel much like an island, although one could argue that it does. But I was really thinking about the ways that the ascription of insular as a kind of adjective for all kinds of material culture and language coming out of the North Atlantic has this kind of like mystical quality. When I'm imagining insular, I am really taken back for good and for ill to Clive Owen's King Arthur and the way that it was shot and just this kind of perpetual mist all the time. And it has this sort of mythical quality. And it's really hammed up in ways that make the alterity of the medieval insular in that sense feel like very sexy and very attractive. And I think that's been one of the things that has perpetuated a real investment in the medieval and medievalism as a kind of popular culture aesthetic. And on one hand, that's maybe a good thing, right? Like it gets people thinking and interested in this time period. But on the other hand, it simplifies it in a lot of ways. And for me, I was thinking about the ways that insularity is made this sort of sexy thing in the medieval world and then made in other places this sort of juridical force that racializes people, that throws them under the kind of hammer of colonialism in very specific ways that the medieval North Atlantic like never really has to contend with. It never has to contend with these legacies of insularity. And so for me, I really wanted to think and name the negative valences of what I call in this piece insular exceptionalism, because the same insularity that's being ascribed to places like Puerto Rico is not being ascribed to Ireland, to the UK. Like these are places that escape the colonial baggage of insularity and somehow like get to exist in this very attractive place of insularity. So I really wanted to name that. And it's such a privilege to think alongside these people who are here on the podcast, but also, as you mentioned, alongside Glissant, thinking less about the insular and more about the archipelago and what it means for us to reframe our understanding, particularly of the medieval North Atlantic, not as insular, but as archipelagic. And what does that do to shining light on the ways that insularity is sort of used as a cudgel in these other sort of circumstances?
And you mentioned in particular in your contribution, Taryn, the insular cases. And I was wondering if for those listeners who haven't encountered this term before, if you could tell us a little bit more about what the insular cases are and how that informs your reading.
I will say I'm not the expert, so I'm happy to give a very legal textbook definition of the insular cases and all of the people who were immediately impacted by the insular cases say some more. But essentially, it was a group of rulings that the Supreme Court handed down that were trying to negotiate the territorial status of Puerto Rico and what the United States' responsibility was going to be to Puerto Rico as a territory. And in those cases, the way that the justices spoke about Puerto Rican people was just so aggressively racist. And those cases still stand. They are still the legal precedent for understanding territoriality. So yeah, I would love to hear from John or Nayard about what you have to say about the insular cases too.
Taryn, reading your paper and how you talked about these cases, you show how they use the idea of the Anglo-Saxon as a contrast to Puerto Rico. The United States has these Anglo-Saxon values, which to me makes no sense. When I think of that term, Anglo-Saxon, and then to use that to say that Puerto Rico is somehow lesser than these values, and therefore they have to be a territory. And the way that you really showed using that sort of exceptional insularism to say Puerto Rico doesn't count. That was intense to read because I feel like inherently you know these things, but once in a while, someone gets that wording that makes it make more sense to you in a way. You're naming something that's there and now I have a name for it. You're saying, Terrence, like, oh, I'm talking about something. I have three Puerto Ricans here. But it's like, oh, but I don't have to talk about it because Terrence is talking about it. And to me, that was very powerful. I don't know if, Jonathan, you want to add anything.
I share Nayard's sentiments here, Taryn. I deeply appreciated reading your paper. As you say, we are still struggling against the weight of these racist rulings. They have shaped our lived experiences in many ways. We are insular cases. And while I have the talking stick, I'll just clarify something. I can easily see how my previous explanation of insularity as a mode of connectivity might seem somewhat naive. I know our history. I know that our earliest historiographical sources were produced in a context in which Puerto Rico was already a colony. I know that the legacies of colonialism remain an unerasable scar on the Caribbean. I've read my Césaire, my Fanon, and my Winter too. That being said, I refuse to accept our colonial condition as the sum of our history, even in light of global trends that in many ways seek to homogenize culture. In light of the concerning efforts of wealthy Americans to turn our island into a paradise for their amusement built by and at the expense of Puerto Ricans, the next Singapore, and I'm quoting here, that's what they want to do, you will still find us resisting in many ways. We still dance our bomba and our plena, clear celebrations of our African roots that are very much entwined with resistance movements. We refuse to forget our indigenous history as well. That is why we call ourselves Boricuas, to honor the indigenous name of our island, Boriquen. I know, Nair, that you love one verb that we use in Puerto Rico a lot, bregar, which can roughly be translated into work, but that really doesn't capture all the nuances that go into this term. When you ask someone how they are doing on the island, a common response is, estoy bregando, estoy en la brega. Basically, working through it, but also in the midst of it, or just surviving. And I think that in some ways, that term beautifully captures our resilience. So, back to your paper, Taryn, I want to say that it was in many ways quite painful to read. Supreme justices talking about my ancestors the way that they did, and yet it really helped me better understand and appreciate our long history of resistance.
I'd love that, John. We are insular cases. But Taryn, before moving on, I just wanted to say that when I originally conceived of this project as a whole, awareness of the insular cases and that term was floating in the back of my consciousness. And I think I didn't even necessarily have the faith that someone would bring that into the discussion. And insular cases, obviously important in the formation of the U.S. territories in the 20th century, but important also for the history of Reconstruction in the U.S. So you're bringing in these really important historical moments that resonate throughout the 20th century and into the 21st and shape our institutions and shape our lives in important ways. And I really appreciate that aspect of your contribution. But I want to turn now to Tanvir to ask you this similar question about how your own research conceives of, theorizes, grapples with the insular.
Thank you very much, Sarah. And for me, this answer always depends upon a very specific context, and it shifts from moment to moment, as I'm sure it is the case for many. So for the imminent context, actually, I think I'll begin with a bright note and say that insularity, working as an academic right now as part of this cluster, has actually been a form of connectivity because of the generosity that you and Nair have had with the initial call for this paper and for this cluster, and then the conversations that resulted from this, the community that results from that. So insularity can mean this profoundly connected way of being, and I'm deeply appreciative of that. And I also have to say this bright note because the following comments might get quite dark. And the call for papers, I believe, for this cluster, I first saw this in the summer of 2022. That was about a year after the Taliban had come to power in Afghanistan. And the response in the United States and in Europe had largely been to isolate and cut off Afghanistan in a similar fashion to how other countries such as Iran, Cuba have been treated. And this made it extraordinarily difficult to reliably get resources from Europe and the United States into the space of Afghanistan, which we should all remember is a space that has suffered 40 years of imperial warfare, which is also a climate war due to famine, water crisis, and other forms of environmental degradation. So in this context, insularity is a condition that is imposed upon the space of Afghanistan. And it's done in such a way to basically effect an act of collective hand washing on part of Americans and Europeans, because then Afghanistan can become a place about which nothing can be done, right? The fault of violence in Afghanistan is something that is essentially Afghan. We see this on clear display in Joe Biden's comments immediately after the United States' withdrawal. So insularity functions as a sort of moral exculpation for Europeans and Americans because the root cause of violence can be assigned to Afghans. And so violence in Afghanistan is not the result of actually the highly connected history where for decades upon decades, imperial warfare has been waged upon the space, but it's just something innate to Afghans that then kind of erupts outwards and the only possible response can be to cut it off. And this is a way of justifying collective punishments such as starvation and the theft of literally billions of dollars from the people of Afghanistan. And that securitized vision of Afghan history is completely at odds with Afghan historical narratives themselves, or the bulk of them at least. So one of those narratives is that sometime in the deep past, when the whole world was drowned in a flood by divine decree, there's a single mountain, there's a mountain called Mount Kund, which is located in the regions which today comprise Afghanistan. And during the time of that flood, Mount Kund was turned into a literal island, as in it was a piece of land surrounded on all sides by water. And because Mount Kund was still above water, it was able to offer refuge to what humans and animals had escaped from this great flood. Now, that story of Mount Kund's ephemeral and primordial insularity embeds Afghanistan, or the spaces that became Afghanistan, into the vaster Islamic cosmos, into the globe. So it presents the spaces of Afghanistan as global spaces, inextricably connected to other spaces and other times. And in the midst of all that, it offers a sort of pride of place to Mount Kund, in that the region was actually picked out by divine decree in order to shelter humanity at a moment of deep existential crisis. And that generous and connected vision of Afghan history stems from an insularity which is profoundly at odds with our own contemporary insularity and that vision of Afghanistan today, which enforces the ongoing sieges.
Beautiful. I just want to say, Tanvir, that reading your paper was also incredibly meaningful to me. And one of the things that I got from your paper was this idea that these sort of hidden long histories, this long history that pushes again the history that wants to be told of a space, that by bringing us into this past, that it's breaking with the way that colonialism and imperialism wants to create a history. I'm really thankful that you trusted us to send us your abstract and you trusted us with your paper.
Thank you, Nair, and I'm likewise profoundly grateful for yourself having created the space for these sorts of conversations. That is not an easy thing.
So important to hear how the three of you have talked about insularity. And I think Sarah and I are going to step back a little bit. We want to hear what the three of you have to say about each other's papers now that you've had a chance to read them. John, would you like to get us started?
Thanks. I do have a question for Tanvir. One of the things that struck me about your paper, Tanvir, is this tension you identify between this long discursive tradition that seeks to identify the territory of Lahman as the post-diluvian refuge for the survivors of the flood, and the kind of narrative that imperial interests try to superimpose in the territory. One of the things the podcast medium allows us to do very well is to peek behind the curtain a bit and learn about aspects of the research process that didn't make it into the article. So my question, how did you arrive at your topic?
Thank you very much, John. The story behind how I came to this topic is actually somewhat chaotic, so I will attempt to keep it trim for the sake of the podcast. There is a town in northern Afghanistan called Mehtarlam, which is literally the name of Noah's father. It's commonly known in English, I believe, as Lamech. So the awareness that Noah's father is held to be buried somewhere there in Lahman has been with me for a while through basic geographic awareness of Afghanistan. But the narrative itself of Noah, the ark landed over there and Lam and Noah showed up, that actually, I first came across this while going through this body of text from the days of the British Empire, which are the colonial gazetteers. And the gazetteers are these compendiums of historical information about regions in which the British Empire had its colonial interests. So I've actually spoken to a couple other South Asians who have had this same morbid curiosity of flipping through these immensely massive volumes and trawling through them and wondering whether one's family or one's region is going to show up and what these people have said about them and so on and so forth. So honestly, I was doing that when I first came across the historical narrative in which some British agents had written down the story of Mount Kunt as related to them by informants within Afghanistan. And this was interesting in and of itself as a material, but it became even more so at a different point where I happened to be reading a different text. This one is from the mid-16th century, and it's the Memoirs of Babur. So Babur was this wandering Mongol prince who became king in Kabul during the early 1500s and is now considered today to be the founder of the Mughal Empire. And I found in these memoirs there was another mention of the same post-Diluvian history in which Noah's Ark and Noah's family had somehow ended up in Lagman. So that was the signal to me that this has actually been there for quite some time, and thus the interest came about in trying to piece together this story.
Thanks, Tanvir. I think that Taryn is getting ready to jump in, so I'll pass the mic to her.
Thanks for letting me interrupt here. I was so struck as we're thinking about themes and how we each came to this work. In reading both of your papers, John, I'd had a chance to read yours before, but Tanvir, this was the first time that I'd gotten to look at it. And I felt such kinship in it for reasons that maybe we can talk about later. But one of the things that I was thinking about with both of your papers, as opposed to mine, is the way that the colonial imaginary in something like the insular cases really constructs insularity in the service of this kind of imagined Anglo-Saxon civility. Like, it is a constructed thing. But both of your papers are really meditating in the most poetic, beautiful ways about the liberatory potential of imagined insularity. And I wonder if it's worth just sort of thinking about this difference between insularities that are imagined, that are perhaps more like Lisant's archipelago, that are perhaps more connective, that are doing something different than the kind of juridical constructions of insularity in something like the insular cases, or indeed in something like the insular North Atlantic. I think it's worth meditating on this difference between imagination and construction. So that's for either of you, John, maybe if you want to start.
What a wonderful question, Taryn. And I'll actually try to weave in some of the thoughts I had about your paper in my response. Your discussion of insular exceptionalism against the backdrop of the insular cases raises two vital questions for me. The first one is an ontological one. What counts as an island? As Tanvir's paper shows, even a mountain can turn into an island in the space of a narrative. And as you joked in passing a bit earlier, Taryn, one could even make the argument that Montana is an island in some sense. The second question is an epistemological one. Who decides what counts as an island? And I think that what your paper does very well is to illustrate the very serious stakes of this second question. To address your question specifically about these imagined versus juridically constructed insularities, my initial sense is that at their core, they are both imagined. What the documents of the insular cases describe is not Puerto Rico. These documents enshrine a fabricated fantasy that justifies a colonial agenda that endures to this day. But when we critically approach insularity as something that is fundamentally imagined, I think that that is when insularity can best serve as a means of empowerment. To return to my paper, I'm not arguing, as you say, Taryn, that one Latino sees Ethiopia as an island in a literal sense. But as Latino speaks of Ethiopia in the Austrias Carmen, he imagines the Ethiopians existing freely. And some might say I'm reading too much into the few mentions of Ethiopia in this poem, but I stand by my interpretation. For instance, Latino writes, "The distant Ethiopians flee, and those at the end of the earth, every prosperous Arab, terrified Egyptian, Indian, imagine the sound of artillery and naval combat, and in their ancestral rituals, they pretend to fight the ships." To contextualize this passage a bit, this mention of Ethiopia happens in the context of a celebration, as the goddess Fama flies all over the world, spreading the news of the Holy League's victory over the Ottoman navy. I do think that Latino is genuinely celebrating the Holy League's victory over the Ottomans. But I do think that Latino understands very well what it is to exist in Europe as a black subject in a time of increasing racial prejudice. So what I find interesting about this passage is the mention that the Ethiopians are fleeing to the ends of the earth, meaning that they are safe from the very imperialist interests that would enslave bodies like his. I am also interested in this mention of the ancestral rites as a way of maintaining a connection to the past, because part of what an enslaved subject is denied by the state is this very connection to the past, this very connection to the ancestors. That is not to say that enslaved subjects did not maintain this connection in various ways, but the state does not recognize this connection as a legitimate source of knowledge, as a legitimate source of identity even. Let me wrap up quickly because I need to pass the mic to Tanvir and I think I've been talking too long. But what I mean by saying that Latino imagines Ethiopia as an island is that he envisions this place in his poetry as an epistemic refuge. He envisions Ethiopia as a place where Ethiopians are free, and where they are able to maintain their connection to the past, where that kind of link to the ancestors has not been severed by imperialist interest. And it is, for me, very important that he is writing this in the wake of the Atlantic slave trade. Living in Spain in the late 16th century, I believe that Latino could see what was coming. Tanvir, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Taryn, for bringing up this wonderful tension, right, between the juridical and the imaginative. And I very much connect with both, John, what you've just said about the ways that one could actually even attempt to equalize or slip past the juridical constraints of Juan Latino's time through that imagination, through history, through that creation of an alternate temporality. And also, Taryn, in your paper, in which the fantasias of the North Atlantic world might actually cloak something, right? Might actually serve as a sort of protective force for the basic idea of these being islands. The mist that came up earlier when you were speaking about the Clive Owen King Arthur, and even through the materials that you presented in the paper, reminded me of that horrible sort of sepia filter that seems to be on television and movies for any single time that, I don't think it's just the Middle East. I think that in Mexico, like, you go anywhere vaguely south on American TV and all of a sudden we all have the sepia filter on the camera for some reason, right? Like, it's just always there. This is what was on my mind when you were talking about that mist, which generates in one context mystery and interest, right? And in another, our sepia mist is one that creates danger. So that's where I think the tension between the juridical and imaginative stuff actually becomes very live. Because even our imaginations of these places today in the visual stuff that we consume is completely suffused with the same logics that govern the juridical isolation of places that are deemed to be dangerous, places that you simply cannot go there no matter what, right? Nothing good ever comes out from there. And I think that's where, on the best of days, I think one would hope that what you have said comes to pass, and that what John is actually describing right now is at least the direction in which one can hope to move, in which there is some force behind being able to narrate a textured, a brightly colored, like non-filtered in some way, or at least hit with a different filter vision of history. And I think this sounds very much like John's paper and what you have just been saying, in that, no, Ethiopia does not have to be the thing which you automatically assume it to be, and we can actually try to speak of these things equal to equal. And I think that given our world of deep capitalism, a lot of that depends on market and power and whom one knows and how one can actually get these narratives out, right? So that's why even the processes by which Juan Latino can produce these things are of deep interest to me, and why I think that a serious consideration of the question that you were asking, Taryn, is one that has to account for the ways that we can actually promulgate our narratives today. And that's a sort of craft question on the academic side.
I love that so much. I think it's such a brilliant articulation. And as you were speaking, I went immediately to this sort of like late aughts, early 2010s moment of Clive Owen's King Arthur, which is probably because Keira Knightley's Guinevere did something for me. But also too, I'm thinking of like Britannia and Vikings and like all of these sort of shows. And I'm thinking if you just like scroll through the game catalog and PlayStation or something, the just preponderance of the kind of medieval aesthetic that does have this particular kind of like blue fog filter that seems to be ubiquitous for this moment. And how, if you think then on the other side of that, games like Red Dead or things that are meant to be kind of frontier-y, which does take place somewhere in like the American Southwest, as you suggest, like something that's southerly, is immediately hit with this like sepia tone. It's really interesting to think about the aesthetics of this and what we can do as scholars to resist those kind of aesthetic cues that become ingrained.
I can jump in here. One of the real areas of connection between your research, John Tanvir Taran, is the way that each of these contributions is exploring not only the conceptual and the topographical resonances of islands, but thinking deeply about temporalities as well, the ways in which it's sort of impossible to understand these insularities that, as Tanvir suggests, are always local, are always contingent constructions of the insular, and are never innocent either. But they're always tied somehow to time. We've just been talking about the temporalities of medievalism and the way that that temporal, but also cultural and epistemic alterity is evoked in popular media. But it strikes me that, John, in your paper, you're thinking about Ethiopia being both forcibly separate, perhaps for its own survival or sake, but also somehow displaced in time. Tanvir, you mentioned the sort of deep primordial, indeed the antediluvian history that's being evoked in these medieval texts. And Taran, you deftly and gracefully move between thinking about the construction of insularity in the contemporary and 20th century world with the medieval texts of the North Atlantic. Were there any other thoughts that you wanted to share about time or temporality and how it's informing your sense of what we mean by the insular?
Sarah, I think this is incredibly important, the question of temporality here. And I think that the core of this question for me is about which pasts are hermeneutically and semiotically rich. What is the body from which we can actually draw meaning for writing history? And what is bunk? What is superstition and myth? What is historical narrative? And I think that toggling between different temporalities actually exposes this process. And that's where I locate the importance of being able to hold different temporalities in one's head at the same time while one is writing, not necessarily to privilege any of these things over the other, but I think it is important to figure out how we can write with histories that not only give us a view of the past that is strikingly different, but that expose the hyper-contingent epistemologies with which we operate in the Western Academy today. Because there are necessary structures that exist right now, some of which we push against, some of which we negotiate, some of which we attempt to bend, some of which we try to escape. But these are things which all inform our own practices. And I think that being more and more aware of the boundaries of our own episteme might also bring us into the position where we can actually ask not only how we continue to be implicated in colonial processes today, how our knowledge production is actually complicit with empire and its violence, but then also, okay, what do we do? All right, because I think that we do need to have an honest conversation about that on a broad level. Again, this is a craft question at the end of the day. And I think that being able to rise to that question with discomforting honesty will perhaps be aided by being able to sketch out more fully where our own boundaries and commitments lie as participants within the academy. And that's something which these other temporalities, I think, really bring to light.
That's such a beautiful way to think about this question of temporality. And of course, there is something inherently temporal about my theorization of insular exceptionalism, because the place that is classified as insular in an exceptional sense is a place that is geographical, but also in the past. England in particular is still certainly benefiting from this insular exceptionalism of the Middle Ages, if we want to speak so broadly about it. So there's still a benefit to contemporary England for medieval England being classified as insular. This is in part because it is not racialized. But I think it's also because, precisely as you've talked about here, Tanvir, the ways in which stories get deployed as historical facts or pots of proof from which we can extrapolate cultural knowledge, places, narratives, and myths that become epistemic traditions those things are not looked at in a derogatory way when they come from a place that's steeped in insular exceptionalism. There's not a kind of like looking down upon some of these myths and creation stories. They're glorified as things that we should be putting on a pedestal. And that's not true everywhere. And I was struck so much in your essay about the moment where the Ark lands on this mountain, specifically because the mountain was humble. It didn't seek to exceed the floodwaters. There was a moment of humility. And so that's what happened. And I was immediately brought back to in my community, I'm Salish. And I remember when I was really little, my grandpa telling me about why the pine trees keep their leaves in the winter. And the story is really about when Creator was preparing the valley for humans to come, he went to all the trees and he said, I need you to stay awake and be vigilant for monsters because I'm going to have someone coming who will take care of these monsters so that people can come here. And all of the trees went to sleep except for the pine tree. And because they stayed awake, because they performed this act of service, they get to keep their needles all year long and all of the rest of the trees lose them every year as not an act of punishment because it doesn't hurt them to do so, but like as a mark of their relationship to humans. And the trees that are most close to us are trees that keep their leaves all winter. And so I was just thinking about the resonances between these stories and like what a comfort it was to see that work and the story of the mountain's humility in a deeply scholarly piece. This thing that I had so much resonance with, not as a scholar, but just as a human being that cared about the story and the importance of the narrative. And so I really appreciated the way that you kind of wrote that into the broader argument that you had about the importance of these critical conversations. To step back and think more about temporality, I also had a really great time writing this piece thinking alongside Vince Diaz, who's a Pacifica scholar, and thinking about sea navigation, specifically for Pacifica peoples and how that was an act of temporality. And to wayfind wasn't just navigating by like landmarks or the stars or any of these things, but was actually about at what time you would see certain animals in certain places, because there is a kind of cyclical teleology to the way that non-humans move through the world and interacting and finding your temporal location based on the temporality of other than humans is actually a really important way to navigate this space. And using those temporal cues as much as geographic clues really disrupts the demarcation between land and water in this sense. And it creates a much more relational form of moving through the world, wherein it's not just continents and everything else is like some backwater, right? But it becomes a kind of extension that like the land and the water are extensions of one another. And that can't really happen without dislocating yourself temporally from a kind of continental linearity. And so I think that underlining all of these questions, how we locate ourselves, not just in place, but also in time, is really hugely important.
Taryn, I loved that very beautiful resonance that you brought up with the pine tree. I think this is a very lovely way to illustrate exactly what the stakes are over here for those temporalities. Reading your piece, for example, and coming across a seafarer, one can easily see the ways in which, okay, the analysis of this poem or the analysis of this figure within the world of islands can be one about loss, or I believe you had mentioned the issue of what happens when one loses their liege lord, or what happens when one needs to be guided to the epistemological frameworks of God or something like this. And that would be an easy analysis to sort of put onto a piece of literature like this, one that really gets at those first principle existential concerns that might drive the production and reception of that piece of literature. And it is, I think, precisely that same attention that then needs to be afforded to the pine tree. And that attention and being able to actually connect that to something like, well, here are a ton of Muslim narratives about humble mountains, right? That actually cuts against these long-standing organizational frameworks we have in the academy, in history of religions, for example, that would say that this is not the case. How many of us have gone to institutions where one comes across the concept of Judeo-Christian religions or Abrahamic religions or monotheisms, and then so Islam, Christianity, Judaism, these materials are grouped in one hand, and then, oh, and then we have indigenous religions, here we have East Asian religions, South Asian religions, and so on and so forth. We have these groupings, and those elide the resonance that you had just mentioned, right? There are actually other extremely profound connectivities that one could affect. We can have conversations along this level if we are attentive to these perhaps raw existential concerns and actually ask the question of, why does it matter that the pine tree actually stayed awake? What does it say about the mountain when it is humble? And I think that is actually, if not a shared conversation in that they are historically informed by people talking to each other in the deep past, something which the apparatus of the academy can help us do today. And I think that is actually a note of hope, at least.
The thing that I really loved about Tanvir, your articulation of hope at the end, is to kind of kick this back to Nayir and Sarah. The way that you structured the workshops from the very beginning, I mean, from the CFP where you were so intent on the language that you use and the way that you really thought to schedule the workshops, and the way that that didn't feel like a deadline and it didn't feel like something perfunctory, but it was one of the most enriching writing experiences I have had in my academic career. And I have just felt from the get-go that not just in the scholarship, not just in the content of this cluster, but in its actually material creation, you have modeled the very best of the insular as a point of connection. And so for me, this question of hope that you've offered us, or this like provocation of hope, just really speaks to the work that both of you have done as editors to make it happen.
Thank you so much, Taryn. I think the great hope of an editor or a facilitator is that by bringing together the labor, the personalities, the great intellectual force of people working in these disciplines, which are sometimes siloed in incredibly forceful and problematic ways, into a space where there can be that meaningful, not just conversation, meaningful contact and relationship building in that space should be the work of academic publications. And I know Nahir and I are both incredibly grateful for the support that we have also received from the Viator editorial staff. This is one of the journals where collaboration is possible, and a themed issue that cuts across so many different ways of thinking with and about islands, insularities, time frames, topographies. It's been incredibly generative and meaningful for us as well.
I agree. I keep using the word grateful, but I don't know what other word to use. I am grateful that Sarah approached me to do this. I am grateful that Viator basically just is letting us do it. I am grateful that Tanvir stayed extra and talked to me. I'm grateful that Taryn and Jonathan agreed to submit papers and trusted us with their research. The three of you, Taryn, Tanvir, Jonathan, you are also early career scholars. You're starting your trajectories in many ways. And I feel, again, grateful that you trust us. And Sarah, for being the best editor ever. I guess if we have to end this, which has been way too much fun and we don't want it to end, I'm gonna end it with that gratitude that I feel to have you all be part of my community. So thank you, everybody.
This has been an episode of The Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Link, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.